This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thanks for tuning in to Eco Radio KC. On tonight's program, the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability is holding their national conference in Kansas City this week, so we'll give you a sneak preview. We'll also be speaking with Dana McDaniel from Seed Savers KC. But first, I'm Naturally, and I'm glad to be here with you the day after our very own Kansas City Royals became world champions. Here's your environmental news. The WashingtonPost.com reports, a sudden spike of earthquakes in southern Kansas is raising eyebrows in the region, where there have been more earthquakes in the past 2 weeks than there were in the years between 1990 and 2013. As of October 26th, there have been 52 earthquakes in Kansas since October 15th, most of a magnitude around 2 or 3.0. According to the Kansas Geological Survey, there were just 19 earthquakes in the state between 1990 and 2010. There were no recorded earthquakes in 2011 or 2012. The number of earthquakes in the state jumped from 4 in 2013 to 817 in 2014, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Quote, in a typical year prior to 2013, we might have picked up 1, 2, 3 earthquakes, said Rex Buchanan, interim director of the Kansas Geological Survey at the University of Kansas. All of the state's earthquakes over the past stretch occurred in just two southern counties that run along the Kansas-Oklahoma border, raising questions about the quake's ties to hydraulic fracking in the region, although industry disputes the connection. In 2000, there were just under 2,000 permitted wells in Kansas. By 2014, that number had grown to more than 7,000. Fracking has been going on in Kansas since the 1940s, but the recent innovation of horizontal drilling instead of vertical requires more water. Buchanan said that the earthquakes are likely being caused by the wastewater disposal wells, not the act of drilling itself. A 2015 study from Stanford researchers came to similar conclusions. The study found that a spike in earthquakes in Oklahoma was caused by wastewater disposal wells, not drilling. ScienceDaily.com reports, the 2015 Antarctic ozone hole area was larger and formed later than in recent years, said scientists from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. On October 2, 2015, the ozone hole expanded to its peak of 28.2 million square kilometers, an area larger than the continent of North America. Throughout October, the hole remained large and set many area daily records. Unusually cold temperature and weak dynamics in the Antarctic stratosphere this year resulted in this larger ozone hole. In comparison, last year the ozone hole peaked at 24.1 million square kilometers on September 11, 2014. Compared to the 1991 to 2014 period, the 2015 ozone hole average area was the fourth largest. The ozone hole is a severe depletion of the ozone layer above Antarctica that was first detected in the 1980s. The Antarctic ozone hole forms and expands during the Southern Hemisphere spring, August and September, because of the high levels of chemically active forms of chlorine and bromine in the stratosphere. These chlorine and bromine-containing molecules are largely derived from human-made chemicals that steadily increased in Earth's atmosphere up through the early 1990s. The ozone layer helps shield Earth from potentially harmful ultraviolet radiation that can cause skin cancer, cataracts, and suppress immune systems, as well as damage plants. The large size of this year's ozone hole will likely result in increases of harmful ultraviolet rays at Earth's surface, particularly in Antarctica and Southern Hemisphere, in the coming months. Ozone depletion is primarily caused by human-made compounds that release chlorine and bromine gases in the stratosphere. Beginning in 1987, the internationally agreed upon Montreal Protocol on substances that deplete the ozone layer has regulated these ozone depleting compounds. Because of the protocol, atmospheric levels of these ozone depleting compounds are slowly declining. The ozone hole is expected to recover back to 1980 levels in approximately 2070. And finally, GreenAbilityMagazine.com reports, when residents and businesses look to install rooftop solar panels, cities can make a big difference with solar-friendly permits and codes. In the Kansas City metro area, the Mid-America Regional Council developed the Solar Ready Community Recognition Program to encourage communities to make it easier to install solar. So far, there are seven that have met the criteria. They include Belton, Clay County, Gladstone, Kansas City, Missouri, Lee Summit, Liberty, Raymore, and Shawnee. Each community has implemented best management practices that include creating solar-ready construction guidelines, adding solar energy provision and development codes, implementing solar permit checklists, and adding information about solar energy installations on their website. Earlier this year, the Mid-America Regional Council launched the Metro Kansas City Solar Map website to help residents view the solar potential for any rooftop in the region. Users can search an address and click on any rooftop to view its solar potential. The site calculates the potential size, the potential system size, electricity cost savings, return on investment, and monthly solar potential for residential and commercial rooftops. Businesses and homeowners can use the tool to estimate costs and energy savings potential of installing solar panels. The website also allows users to highlight a neighborhood or group of buildings to determine the solar potential of all rooftops in a certain community or block. Find the solar mapping website at www.kcsolarmap.org. And now, at this time, I would like to begin our interview with Ms. Dana McDaniel here from Seed Savers KC. Welcome, Dana.
Hi. Happy to be here.
We're so glad to have you. Now, tell us about your organization, Seed Savers KC.
Our organization has been officially working the last 4 years under the name Seed Savers KC. We have been working informally for the last 11 years just through the Nita B. Gorman, Missouri Department of Conservation, where I volunteer at because I started doing seed saving activities and plant activities through their organization. They allow me to use their site. We officially started as a group on Facebook, and then we have become very, very big in the Kansas City area. And we have an annual seed exchange in January. We have an annual plant and seed exchange in May. We have a fall festival. And every month we give free classes on seed saving to anyone who wants to come to them. We also go off-site from the Discovery Center and teach when we're requested to come to talk to groups. So we have some classes coming up this week. We have one on Tuesday evening from 6 to 8 and on Saturday afternoon from 2 to 4. And the Anita B. Gorman Missouri Department of Conservation Discovery Center is located at 4750 Troost, Kansas City, Missouri. It's just right on the outskirts of UMKC or the plaza. So it's real easy to get to.
So that's where you're mostly located? Is that the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center?
That is our official location for the classes and our plant exchange. It used to be for our seed exchange, too, but we have a new venue for our seed exchange January 16th, 2016, from 11 to 2. We will be having our seed exchange at the Hampton Inn and Suites on the plaza.
Now, will you just give me a brief history of seed saving? Why is it important for people in this area to be saving seeds and doing exchanges and such?
Oh, wow. It's so important. We have had such a dramatic loss in biodiversity, and this loss is something that some of these seeds will never, ever be able to recover again. They're just permanently gone because people quit saving them, and they were just lost. And so we feel that if we educate people and teach them how to save seeds properly and let them know that it's very important that we not let the biodiversity continue any further, then hopefully we will have a community of people that will come forward and take seed saving as the wonderful skill that it is, that for thousands of years, farmers have saved seeds. It's not something new. It's not a novel approach that we've just come up with in the 21st century. This has been going on since people began growing anything. And so to me, it's such an important skill that I've taken it upon myself as my mission to teach the greater Kansas City area how to save seeds.
So the class that's coming up this week, it's Seed Saving 101, right?
Yes, yes, so it is.
For anybody who doesn't know how to save seeds, they'll learn?
Yes, you have, when you come out of that class, it's a two-hour class, you will have all the basic skills that you need to successfully save a wide variety of plants, flowers, and vegetables.
Now, are the seeds that we save, so it's not just edibles, it's also flowers and such?
Yes, yes, indeed. Because their flowers are just as important as vegetables are. Mm-hmm. What we're saving is seeds from plants that are called open pollinated. And that would be the opposite of hybrids. Hybrids are plants that are specifically two different parents, a different mom and a different dad. And so they come together and they make children that are called hybrids. Mm-hmm. And these hybrids are not seeds that you can save because they won't come true. You have too much different genetic material coming from the two different backgrounds that when you try to save those seeds, you have no idea what you're going to get. Whereas with the open pollinated things, they come true.
Hmm. Now, how would someone find out where to contact you or how to find out more about these classes?
Well, my phone number, 816-356-9892. You're welcome to call it from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. My website for the group is www.seedsavers-kc.org. And our Facebook is www.facebook.com/groups/seed.savers.kc/.
Okay, well, Dana McDaniel with Seed Savers KC, thank you so much for being here with us this evening.
Well, I am thrilled to be here, and I hope that we have a really good turnout on the classes this week.
All right, coming up next, we're going to have a commentary from Amy Goodman on the upcoming Paris Climate Summit, and then we'll have Richard and Ann and Jay in the studio here.
Storming the Bastille at the Paris Climate Summit. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. World leaders will gather in Paris in just a month to hammer out a treaty to confront the global threat of climate change. It's real, growing, and based on increasing scientific consensus clearly caused by human activity. Since the dawn of the Industrial Age, humans have been dumping pollutants into the sky as if the atmosphere is a bottomless pit, able to absorb an infinite amount of our smoke and exhaust. These greenhouse gases have been forming a blanket around the planet, trapping the heat of the sun. The signs of the crisis are everywhere. 2015 is on course to be the hottest in recorded history. Hurricane Patricia plowed into Mexico last week as the largest hurricane ever recorded in the Western Hemisphere. It wasn't only the power of Patricia, but the speed with which the hurricane formed almost overnight, transforming from a tropical storm. In the Persian Gulf, scientists reported this week that certain population centers are likely to experience temperature levels that are intolerable to humans, owing to the consequences of increasing concentrations of anthropogenic greenhouse gases. In other words, in cities like Doha in Qatar and Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, the daily high temperatures will simply be too hot for people to survive outside for more than a few hours at a time. In the polar regions, ice is melting at unprecedented rates, and the ocean is warming, causing the water to expand. Both phenomena are causing the sea level to rise, already impacting small island nations like Tuvalu, Kiribati, and the Marshall Islands in the Pacific, and the Maldives in the Indian Ocean. Hundreds of millions of people will eventually have to flee the world's coastal cities, scientists predict. The goal is to limit average global temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius or 3.8 degrees Fahrenheit over pre-industrial temperatures. This will require global cooperation on an unprecedented scale and the decarbonization of the economy. In other words, people will have to stop using fossil fuels like coal and oil and rely on renewable energy sources like solar and wind. if this transition can be accomplished in time, scientists and policymakers say before the temperature crosses that critical 2 degrees Celsius threshold, then the planet's climate can be saved. If humans pursue business as usual and do nothing or adopt half measures, climate change will be irreversible and catastrophic. The stakes are high for the Paris Climate Summit. Convened by the United Nations, the meeting is called by its shorthand name COP21 for the 21st Conference of Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC. The process began at the Rio Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992, culminating in the Kyoto Protocol in 1997. While that was a binding treaty, some countries refused to ratify it, most notably the world's historically largest polluter, the United States. This time around, each nation will make voluntary pledges to reduce greenhouse gas emissions with no obvious way to enforce compliance. How will the United States radically transform its economy and rid itself of internal combustion engines, fracked gas, and coal plants by 2050? Fossil fuel industries exert enormous influence on every level of government in the U.S., making even incremental change almost impossible. Thanks to remarkable reporting from Pulitzer Prize-winning Inside Climate News and the Los Angeles Times, we know that ExxonMobil, as early as the 70s, studied and understood climate change. Despite this, Exxon concealed its own findings that fossil fuels cause global warming, alter the climate, and melt the Arctic ice.
This is one of the, if not the most important investigative coups in decades, and these reporters' remarkable work deserves to become part of the kind of common understanding of the entire planet about the most significant crisis human beings have ever wandered into.
Says Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org, a global activist group fighting climate change.
Exxon is probably the one institution on Earth that could have short-circuited this 25 years of pretend faux debate that we've been having about climate change. If in 1989, when Jim Hansen from NASA had stood up before Congress and said, yeah, the planet is warming, if Exxon at that point had said, you know what, he's right. Our internal science, which is very strong in this field, confirms everything that he's saying. The world has a terrific problem. Well, we wouldn't have solved global warming by now, but we'd be well on the way. We would not have engaged in a quarter century of denial and debate.
So incensed was McKibben, he marched down to his local Exxon gas station in Vermont a few weeks ago and blocked access to a gas dump holding a sign that read, "This pump temporarily closed because Exxon lied about climate." McKibben was arrested, but to date, no Exxon executives are facing charges for covering up their findings and lying to the world. While world leaders will assemble for COP21 at Le Bourget, a sprawling convention center in Paris, hundreds of thousands are expected in the streets. Protest organizers have called for global actions on November 28th and 29th, demanding a fair, ambitious, and binding agreement to confront and ultimately reverse the potential for catastrophic human-induced climate change. If the leaders fail, many will be there to storm the Bastille. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
What did Israel's founders mean when they said their country was a Jewish state?
Our understanding of a Jewish state is Jewish in an ethnic sense and not in a religious sense.
And why was it so controversial?
Judaism is an established official state religion of the state of Israel.
I'm Maureen Fiedler, the latest installment of our God and Government series, next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right before The Jazz Disciple.
Since its fur trading and livestock days, animals have been central to Kansas City's identity. Dr. Julie Urbanik, formerly a professor of geosciences at UMKC, will examine the past and present connections between KC's human and animal inhabitants on this week's All Souls Forum, Wednesday at 6 p.m. right here on KKFI.
Good evening, everyone. This is Richard Mabian, and I want you to know I'm really glad to be back. For those folks who know who I am, it seems like I've been gone forever. It's been a lot going on, especially in my life in the last 6 months, and all of it's been, some of it's been good, some of it's been bad, and thank God none of it's really been ugly. but at least we made it through and we're here. I just recently returned from last week. I was in L.A. with a group, the Moving Forward Network, that's dealing with the goods movement in this country. You know, I've had them on the air a couple of times. That's the work that we're doing out there in Argentina with Burlington Northern Railroad, and also with the problem with diesel emission that we got going on in the metropolitan area. So you can guarantee that in the near future I would have those folks back here on the air. I learned a lot. Very, very excited about seeing some things happen here in Kansas City. Also, weekend before last, I put on a historical book fair, and a lot of folks have been wondering, why is an environmental-minded person putting on a book fair? Well, as you know, one of my driving forces now is that if we don't educate our future generation to love science, that we're going to fight. If we think we have problems now, we'll have a horrendous amount of problems then, especially with our low-income communities, because if our kids don't love science, they won't get a job. And with an unemployment rate like we're looking at now with our young people, we need to make sure we're doing all we can to help and assist our youth in being able to prepare for that time of their life. But then it dawned on me, well, if we want our kids to learn to love science, we better teach them how to learn to love reading, because kids don't read anymore. They play games on computers, and they only read as assignments, not because of love. So that's, therefore, we need to also institute a book fair, some kind of annual book fair that's helping to encourage and see our kids, let our kids see us, people who look like them, working together with each other to help them learn how to read. It was a tremendous success, and I look forward to next year already. Now, the reason that kind of stuff is important, because like right now, I'm sitting here with a program we're getting ready to bring to you that I think is vital. I think is really needed to be heard. And right now, you know, many, many of our environmental associates are like preaching to the choir. And we need to be able to find ways to extend that message into the population that lives in the cities, because without them, us knowing means little. So I'm going to start by introducing who's here in the studio with me, which is one of our own hometown girls who I love dearly. And then I'll allow her to introduce the guy we have on the phone. So, Ann.
Okay. I'm Ann Sollentrop, and I'm with the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability. And we will be having our fall national meeting here in Kansas City. We'll be having it at the Precious Blood Center in Liberty, Missouri. And we have a actual panel that's going to be talking 7 p.m. this Thursday, November 5th, at the Precious Blood Center. And we'll be talking about the Westlake dump in St. Louis that is on, there's a dump near the airport in St. Louis that's on fire. It's been on fire since 2010, and it's right next to another dump that has thousands of tons of nuclear or radioactive material. And this is all just coming out into the media recently. We'll also be highlighting the Kansas City plant cleanup. And we have on the line now the president of the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability, Jay Coughlin from Nuclear Watch New Mexico.
Yeah, hi there, Ann. Hi, Richard. I'm calling from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Yes, sir. Jay, it's good to hear your voice again. For those of you who can remember, Jay was one of our speakers at one of the Break in the Silence conference, and it's good to see Jay. You're hanging in there, and you're still bringing this cutting-edge information and knowledge to us around the country. Now,
That's right. Now, last time I saw you, Richard, it was 0 degrees in Kansas City.
Yes, yes.
Damn, that was cold.
Yes.
Icebergs going down the Missouri, so that's not going to happen again this coming Thursday.
Well, you know how ironic this is, because at the book fair, we brought in Booker T. Washington's great-granddaughter, and that was when she was here, too.
It was cold.
She remembers that day, that weekend also. So it's kind of ironic that here we're talking to you, too. Jay, I'm a little disturbed with what I'm hearing. And I want to go straight to that, because you heard me saying about us needing to educate a future generation. But if we don't, and then I want you familiar with what's going on in St. Louis, right?
Generally, yes. Okay, well, I don't pretend to be expert on that particular issue, but generally, okay. Yes.
Between you two, I want to make sure, and I'm going to open up the lines just in case someone in Kansas City wants to say something, but I want to make sure you two thoroughly explain what this circumstance is going on in St. Louis. My better half is from St. Louis, and when I heard about it, I called and told her to listen in. But because, you know, she still has family and friends up there. And the corporate world and our government and the powers to be are destined to keep us ignorant. And so people like us, programs like this, have to step to the forefront. Because if we don't, people will not be aware of what's going on out there. So, Ann, y'all come on. Let's tell people what's happening. First of all, let me give you a number out there if you want to call in. It's 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. Okay.
Well, I just want to say that overall, the nuclear weapons enterprise has a long history of being all about production, making bombs and making waste, okay, and not being too worried about people and the environment.
Okay, I'm gonna ask questions. The nuclear waste enterprise, where is it located?
Well, there's 8 major sites in the United States.
So it's not that they in St. Louis?
No, well, that's where the waste is. Okay. That's from actual bomb material that was processed during World War II to make the bombs that hit Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Okay.
And gotcha. So when they were done processing, they just dumped it.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, I wanted to make sure.
Oh, no, that's fine. So there's, you know, this has polluted places all over the U.S., including waterways. All the major rivers in the U.S. pretty much have been polluted. So when we have our national meetings, we have it in different parts of the country, and we ask people from that local area to highlight their problems. Okay. So little by little, we cover the whole country that way.
Okay, so this fire that you're talking about at this dump has been going on since 2010?
Right, and it's just a regular dump.
Regular dump.
Yeah, and it's 3 football fields or 1,000 feet away from a radioactive dump.
Okay. Got you. Now, is the picture being painted to you out there, the ones that are listening? In other words, we have those kind of situations that we hear about from time to time when a dump will catch on fire. Methane, more than likely, somehow ignited and it started. Is it underground?
It's smoldering underground.
It's smoldering underground. But the problem with this one is about 3 football fields away from a nuclear dump.
Uh-huh. That's
which
right.
Could be horrific. What could just give some example? Okay, Jay, I'll come to you on this. Give me some examples of what could happen if, in fact, that flame was to reach that nuclear dome.
Well, it's certainly possible that there could end up being airborne radioactive air emissions. But I hasten to point out that anecdotally, there appears to already be a problem here, and that apparently there are clusters of cancers in the surrounding neighborhoods. Now, I don't have the facts and figures at my fingertips, but as Ann stated, we're going to have a panel. It's basically concerning nuclear waste issues in the state of Missouri. And we're going to have one fellow from the Missouri Coalition for the Environment, Ed Smith, come speak on that panel. He's been pretty prominent in national news reporting on this dump.
Okay.
But, you know, just to quickly recap, as Ann stated, there's currently 2 separate dumps, but there's an underground fire approximately 1,500 feet from waste. Now, this is historically very interesting, I think. It's basically from depleted uranium, and it was the Mellenkraut, I believe is how you pronounce it, facility in St. Louis that kind of did some of the pre-milling or pre-treatment of this uranium ore, this high-grade uranium ore from the Congo. that ended up being the nuclear material for the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima in World War II.
Boy, it's you know, it's a shame how everything is connected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, so now, what can citizens do? We're talking different kind of citizens. Ones, you got the citizens in Kansas City, Missouri, I'm a Kansas boy, but in Kansas City metropolitan area that will be attending this this session that you're having. So what is it that you think they can do? But also, what is it that people in, do you feel the people in the St. Louis metropolitan area need to be doing?
Well, there is an online petition, and I've signed it and forwarded it on to people I know. It's, you know, something that the politicians are kicking around, you know, like, well, you're, you know, pointing fingers at one another. I've heard that the Attorney General, I believe it was, from Missouri is suing the dump, the people that run the dump. People that live around there, of course, are worried about their property values going down. They want to be compensated. There's already a problem with air quality. They say their eyes are burning. They can't, you know, it's hard to breathe. They keep their windows closed. It's a bad smell. So it's already a problem.
Okay. Jay, what is the media's role in this?
Well, the media's role is obviously important, just to get the word spread. And, you know, you ask what people can do.
Right.
And I'll just immediately, you know, by reflex, I'll respond, get active.
Yeah.
Just get active, make your voice known. Now, of course, the media just didn't somehow miraculously stumble across this story. People had to contact them.
Okay.
And now it's becoming national news. Now that the media has a hold of it, this then creates pressure on politicians, both local, congressional, national, et cetera. But hopefully, you know, it starts with people. It
yeah.
starts with people fighting to protect their children and their property. So just get active, get the word out there, and bring pressure upon your levels of government to fix things.
Well, you know, one of the things that I experienced this past week when I was in L.A. with this Moving Forward Network, and the reason that I really started associating with them is because they are responsible for creating on-the-ground local community-based groups to become active in addressing the issues of those problems. And
I just have to say right on, it's the people
yes,
that lead
yes,
in history.
Yes, I
not
mean,
not the
they,
politicians,
that's right,
it's the people.
The people, and these groups really got their birth out of East L.A., so most of them are Hispanic groups, which mm-hmm. is fabulous to sit there and watch these people operating. But they also have universities attached to them. Do we have that? Do we have the support and involvement of local universities in these kinds of issues?
Well, we need to press for that. That's
yeah.
for sure. We had an exhibit at UMKC just over the Hiroshima Nagasaki anniversary to try to reach out and educate the public about issues pertaining to nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and nuclear weapons. The attendance was not so good at
right.
some of the presentations. So I think what we can do is bring it to the environmental communities, the people that are concerned about the environment, and let them know this is a problem
right.
with the environment.
Well, but and I'm not knocking that, because I think that's great. I one of my reasons about concern about the media, Jay and Ann, is because on the Harlem Book Fair, I had to literally go off on the media. I'm being honest with you. Because here we are doing something that is trying to save our children, and no one says a word, not a word. But if a kid got shot in a drive-by shooting, I wake up listening to it. I listen to it when I eat my lunch. I'm listening to it when I go to bed at night. You can't say enough. Now, granted, I know that those kind of stories help pay your bills, and I'm not going to be one to tell you I'm against you paying your bills. But as I listed myself, because, Jay, since you was here, I am also the president of the Kansas City, Kansas NAACP. I felt like that as president of the Kansas City, Kansas NAACP, I needed to see more balance. I needed to see us talking about the media, talking about the things that we're doing to become activists, to become concerned about bettering our communities. And I was just wondering, do you think there's some type of way that this environmental community that we keep talking to could ever come to the point of saying, hey, y'all, let's start as a group of people approaching these media outlets about what we're talking about? Because the bottom line, and I'm telling you, is the destruction of us as people. The corporations have made us second-class citizens across this nation, and they're doing things in and around and behind our backs without That's saying right. a word to mm-hmm. us, okay?
Well, you know, what happened in St. Louis was a year ago the county came up with a disaster plan. What if that fire, you know, exploded that radioactive material? And so, big catastrophe, right? But they didn't tell anybody.
Tell them about this.
And so the moms in St. Louis found out about it, and they started a Facebook page. And that's when all the fury, you know, came out. And they've had some public meetings now where hundreds of people have showed up, and they're very, very upset.
It just shouldn't be that way. And, Jay, you could jump in anytime you want, but it shouldn't be that way. All of us work hard.
So you invited me to jump in, so here I go, whoopee.
Yeah.
I'm not telling you anything, Richard, that you don't already know. What does an activist do? He or she keeps on going.
Right.
That's what you do. Clearly, this country is becoming more and more of a run by corporations, and there's a very heavy profit motive, you know, that's just meshed through yeah. all of this. And Ann earlier noted how, you know, it's been historically production above all, and later on cleanup. One thing I want folks, your listeners, to know out there, this country is getting ready to embark upon a $1 trillion modernization of all its complete nuclear weapons forces, the missile subs, bombers, rebuilding the existing bombs, etc. While in general, the government at the same time is basically looking to walk away from genuine cleanup of the mess that it has created. And about the best example that I can think of what I just said is the old Kansas City plant. So anyway, folks,
yes.
you know, fighting
yes.
for your children, just get out there and be active and pressure the government to put the money where the true priorities are.
You know, when I first went into the environmental movement, started getting involved, Murdoch, he used to be with Bridging the Gap here in Kansas City. And he told me, Richard, when you go out here and start talking to people, remember that you'll be talking about things that people really don't know. And keep in mind that in every situation and incident, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And, you know, and when you were just saying that about the revamping that they want to do now with the trillions of dollars going into doing things in the nuclear industry, I was realizing that beginning, middle, and end fits so well with what you were talking about, because the things that you name off, and Ann has a list here with her, you know, $95.8 billion for new submarines, okay, new submarines, $62.3 billion for new land-based missiles. What we're doing when we list that stuff is talking about what the money's being spent on. But before you ended there, Jay, you came back to the waste that comes from the production of those devices. And that's something that we don't talk about. We don't talk about that waste, which is a part of that that production process. Yeah, you make it, but in the process of making it, you have this waste that you got to try to figure out how to get rid of. I still haven't got over the fact that when that was killing
Ebola.
Folks here, and that first guy died down there in Oklahoma City. Well, the weekend he died, I was in Oklahoma City, in fact, but the waste from his that was coming from him from his operating room was stuck on a vehicle. They haven't said yet whether it was a train and or truck. And that stuff was secretly moved from Oklahoma City to Kansas City, Kansas. No one knew it. I mean, no one. I mean, I'm not saying they don't have a right to move it from Oklahoma City to Kansas City, Kansas, but at the same time, there you would think that people would be aware. Jay, I mean, we're going to have you back. I got to see you. I just plugged in my Thursday night, and now y'all are destroying my plans. even though you're out there in the part of the country that I don't come to, I might have to find me a somebody to travel with me. I want to see you when you're in town. I think this is worthy of us talking about it. For those people, Maurice will be out here. Maurice Copeland will be on the panel too. Ann, why don't you give that address and stuff again?
It's at Liberty, Missouri, and that's the northeast area of Kansas City metro area. It's at the Precious Blood Center, address 2130 St. Gaspar Way. And if you get lost, you can call my cell, 913-271-7925. You take exit 13 off of I-35 to get there.
All right, Jay, I'm going to have to let you go. We ran out of time.
Very good, Richard.
We still going?
Yeah, we're just taking a break.
Oh, we're taking a break, Jay. Hang on. Be back.
Okay. I'll stick around.
Okay.
Khadija, I heard about this radio show. It's about race.
What? A show about race?
Yeah, on the radio. It's on the community radio station, KKFI.
You're supposed to talk about that around your kitchen table.
Yeah, and that's what I thought, but it's actually on the radio talking about race and racial things.
What time is it?
It's 7 o'clock Thursday.
And what's the name of this show?
Khadija and the White Guy.
Say what?
Yeah, Keith Washburn and...
Khadija Hardaway.
See you then, Thursday night at 7 o'clock.
This is Wilson, and I'm one of the newest volunteers here at 90.1 FM KKFI. If you would like to get involved in volunteering, go ahead and call Bill at 816-994-7869 or go to kkfi.org/volunteer. Thanks for tuning in to 90.1 FM KKFI, your community radio station.
Missed last week's Echo Radio KC? No worries. You can listen online at kkfi.org.
All right, I'm back. Sorry about that mix up there, folks. Sorry about that, Jay. That's me.
Yeah, I'm good.
That's me lack of being in the office. Me and Mike, our head nods and tongue waggings have been distorted. All right, and you had a couple of things you
okay.
wanted to bring in.
So on the panel, we've invited one of the St. Louis moms to tell her story. And Ed Smith, Missouri Coalition for the Environment, and he can talk about more technical aspects. We've invited Mr. Raymond Franson from the Missouri Department of Natural Resources, and he's head of the project to clean up the Kansas City plant. And we don't know if his boss is going to let him come yet or not, but we've at least, requested. And then I was supposed to talk about the Kansas City plant also, but I've been having trouble finding out much of anything about it. So I got a flyer in the mail from CenterPoint in the, it says CenterPoint in the South Kansas City Chamber of Commerce. So I called the number on there a couple of times, never got an answer back. I went online to the website that's listed. There's nothing much on there, just something from last spring. So finally today, I got frustrated. I just called the plant and, got sent around because they didn't think they could talk to me and what have you. And finally, I got to the attorney, Mr. Al Guarino, this afternoon. And I told him the problems that I've been having with this, I wanted to know some information. So he said that they're doing a site investigation. CenterPoint has been contracted to do this. It will take 18 months, at least, he said, And then they're going to, after everything is all investigated and they've got a plan for real redevelopment, then sometime next spring they'll probably have a public session where the public can find out what's going on. So, you know, that seems pretty few and far between because they had an open house in the summer, you know, and that's almost a year later they're going to have a, something for the public. And it says on here that you can go every first and third Tuesday from 1:30 to 3:30 to the Kansas City Chamber of Commerce and find out information. Well, tomorrow they're first Tuesday, but hey, it's going to be the Royals Parade tomorrow, so I'm sure nobody's going to be there, you know. So I asked
You'll
Mr.
probably have the meeting then.
Right. So I asked Mr. Guarino, I said, are they still doing these, you know, things? And he said he didn't really know because there really wasn't much going on to talk about to tell the public. So he was going to find out and get back to me, which was nice.
Yeah, so. But and I'm going to want to add a few things. And,
sure, go ahead. Go ahead.
In Santa Fe, New Mexico, but I have been to the old plant a couple of times. And it's well documented that there's groundwater contamination by both industrial solvents and PCBs. And then you local folks will know better than I, but the old plant sits in a floodplain.
Right.
And it's at the confluence of the Little Blue and is it Indian Rivers, I think?
Indian Creek.
But, but it's in that corner with two moving streams by it. And the only reason why there's no, well, I shouldn't say the only reason, but a reason why there's not, you know, serious off-site contamination right now is because so much of the old plant is impervious surfaces, whether it's the main building or parking lots or what have you. But so there's not ground recharge of rainwater, which would drive off-site the groundwater contamination. Now, with development and demolition of a lot of these impervious surfaces, there could be off-site contamination. And I don't know about folks in Kansas City, but here in New Mexico, we sure value our water. And when it gets contaminated, that's fighting words.
Yep. And we do have a major, just like most places, stormwater drainage problem in both Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas. In some cases where sewage is, human race is coming up in people's yards, okay? And again, due to lack of education, folks don't understand the extent of what that's saying. So when you start telling me about underwater groundwater, groundwater, and you start talking to me about those springs that are down there, and I know when you mention that about the rainwater, we have that kind of runoff here. It could very easily be some of that contamination being seeping and start seeping into the backyards of our residents. And, of course, you know, it's in the lowest portion of our population. Mm-hmm. So education. Jay, while I got you here, I just want to hear your thoughts on the caliber of educational programs that can be produced or should be produced from the community base. I'm not talking about institutions, but from the community base to somewhat complement what's being attempted in our institutions of higher learning.
Well, one quick reaction that I have is, you know, great that you have a lot of education, but make sure it's properly directed. And, yeah, I sit next door to Los Alamos County, which was the birthplace of nuclear weapons. Okay. And that county has the highest percentage of PhDs per capita. And, you know, I want to point out that smarts is not the same thing as wisdom. And I think wisdom is supposed to benefit all of humankind.
Okay.
So, yes, I hear you loud and clear, Richard, and I especially like your advocacy that the local low-income kids should go after science.
Right.
I completely agree with that, but let's have science that benefits all of humankind.
Right.
Let's go for the green energies, et cetera, that can bring us all up and not tear us down.
Well, as a model here, Jay, what I've done is found ways to bring environmental organizations into the education process for our inner city kids. Mm-hmm. I thoroughly believe as a, and I love saying environmental minded because that really gives a projection to perspective to who and what I am. But as an environmental minded person, I'm fully convinced that our best teachers at this juncture, are people, those scientists who are engaged in them environmental organizations.
I agree with you.
Those folks are down. And if you find one, the only thing you have to be concerned about them is those that understand how you educate children. And if you find one, she's golden. She or he is golden. We have one in Kansas City, Kansas, in Kansas City metropolitan area, and she is golden. And I talk to her in terms of when you're working with these children, I want you to do it in such a way that you're teaching them to take your job. Because that's to where it's going to have to come from. The one thing I learned from that group out there in L.A. is that the folks, those young people who are running them organizations now started being educated back when they were in school to this point. So it's taken them 10, 15 years to move those groups from nowhere to where they are now. So that's a process I want to try to introduce here in Kansas City. Jay, we got a caller on the air. Caller, you on the air. Will you give me your first name and the part of the city you're calling from, please?
This is Tom on the edge of Brookside.
Tom okay, Clemmer.
Brother. Sound like a friend of ours. What's going on, buddy?
Mr. Mabian and Mr. Coughlin and Ms. Solentrop. This is Tom Clemmer. And, you know, on my show last week, I was talking to Kristen Iverson about the mess in Rocky Flats, Colorado.
Yes.
Ground polluted with plutonium, of all things.
Right.
And they're wanting to open that up to hiking trails and wildlife refuge, and the government officials are all saying, don't worry, we cleaned it up.
Yeah.
And there's mountains of evidence to the contrary, and I'm wondering how much we're going to see the same thing on the old Kansas City plant site. Now, we didn't have massive amounts of plutonium like Rocky Flats, but they did do an awful lot of machining of beryllium, and I've been to hearings where I heard workers talking about 10, 20 years ago or whenever, machining beryllium, handling it by hand with no protection, using air hoses to clean it off of workspaces and billowing up in the air and going out the roof through roof vents. And then I heard a roofer testifying how he was a contractor just brought in for a month or two, and all this decades of beryllium caked onto the concrete roof that he's cutting into and working on, and he's getting borreliosis, which is something, as I understand it, like lung cancer.
Yes,
and then Centerpoint had an open house at 99th and Holmes that Maurice Copeland and I went to a few months ago, and, you know, having heard all this about the beryllium contaminating everything up on the roof and all over the place for decades, I talked to one of their subcontractors who was slated to or on track to demolish the building. I said, how are you going to keep that from getting out in the air and affecting the workers?
Tom.
And he showed me a picture of a job they did in Chicago. They were just up on a boom with a water hose, and that's how they kept the beryllium down.
Well,
any reaction to that just seems totally inadequate.
Yeah, as much as I could love to sit here and continue this conversation, I got my guy doing that tongue wag at me over there,
yeah.
So you know what that means.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in, Tom, and maybe when Jay's in town, you two can get a chance to kind of kick it. Jay, I'm going to try to get out there myself on Thursday night. And you and Jay, thanks a lot so much for
being
here.
Thank you for having us.
And telling and making people aware. I'm sure the address to that place is going to be on our website, so anyone else who needs to know where it is, take a look at our website. Thanks, folks, and I'll see you the next time that I'm on the air. Thank you now.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, everybody. This is Naturally again, and I'm here to let you know what events are going on around the metro area this week. On today, starting in just 10 minutes at 7 p.m., it'll go till 9 p.m., The Clean Power Plan rule is the first regulation to place limits on power plants' CO2 emissions. Released by the Environmental Protection Agency on August 3, 2015, the Clean Power Plan rule requires each state to develop a plan to cut power plants' CO2 emissions by specific targets. Sustainable Sanctuary Coalition is partnering with the Climate Energy Project and Kansas Interfaith Power and Light to present a briefing of the plan. The briefing will include the 1,560-page rule, including clean power plant emissions requirements and deadlines, ways Kansas can comply with the CO2 emission standards, health benefits resulting from the clean power plan, reduced CO2 emissions, economic opportunities resulting from the CPP. So this event starts at 7 p.m. over on 6641 Mission Road in Prairie Village, Kansas. That's the Village Presbyterian Church. And don't forget Seed Savings 101. That class is tomorrow from 6 to 8 p.m. Go see our first guest, Dana McDaniel, and she'll teach you how to save seeds from your garden. The class will cover why seed saving is important, how to save seeds, and will include demonstrations of different seed saving methods. That workshop is from 6 to 8 p.m. tomorrow at the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center. Find more information at seedsavers-kc.org.
What reservoirs and cows have in common. That and other stories for the week ending November 1st, 2015.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Cod are in hot water, and some like it and some don't. Their numbers in New England have dropped to record lows in the past few decades, a distressing circumstance for a species that was once so plentiful it gave Cape Cod its name.
But in 1992, the Northwest Atlantic cod numbers were around 1% of their historic levels. Since then, despite decades of quotas, the fish have not rebounded, and nobody totally understands why. Until now, perhaps.
A study just released in the journal Science puts the blame squarely on climate change, saying that between 2004 and 2013, water temperature in the area rose an astounding 4 degrees, almost 100% faster than the world's other large saltwater bodies.
The researchers attributed the temperature rise to shifts in ocean currents caused by global warming. And that's produced both winners and losers.
The same warming is fueling a rise in lobster populations, in part because there are fewer cod which eat them, but also because lobsters grow faster in warmer waters.
But seafood lovers shouldn't panic about a cod shortage because other fisheries, such as in the Bering Sea, are doing much better.
But in stark contrast to what's going on in New England waters, another study was published last week showing that cod are recovering off the coast of Newfoundland and Labrador.
Cod in the northern waters became commercially extinct in the 1990s and were a symbol of overfishing. But the authors of this study describe the rebound as the most significant comeback of any fish worldwide.
For 20 years, there has been a moratorium on commercial fishing of the northern cod. But why is the fish coming back in this area, but not further to the south?
One researcher who's been studying cod populations in Maine explained that the cod that inhabit the waters off the coast of Newfoundland and Labrador are in the northern reaches of their range, while those found in New England inhabit the lower end of the range.
The conclusion to draw, if you warm up both areas, Canadian cod will be happier, while those in New England will be out of their comfort zone. So, Franny, what do cows and reservoirs have in common?
What do you mean? One's an animal and one's a body of water.
What they have in common is that they each emit methane. They're both a source of the gas which causes global warming much more powerfully over short periods of time than carbon dioxide.
Okay, so I get a cow's a flatulence. So how is it then a reservoir passes gas?
Well, in a way, a reservoir is like a big cow's stomach. Both the reservoir and cow guts have microbes in them, and those microbes are little bacteria who eat carbon in order to live, and they emit methane.
So since methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, you'd think scientists and activists would be really concerned about dams and reservoirs.
And in fact, they are. Last weekend, representatives of indigenous peoples from all over the world met in Malaysia to celebrate the efforts of local people there who have blocked the building of a new dam. Those attending were from Honduras, Cambodia, Brazil, and the U.S., among others, all concerned about saving rivers.
And the gathering of Native peoples passed a declaration that calls on governments and institutions to stop promoting dams as green energy and to recognize that reservoirs emit large amounts of greenhouse gases, including methane.
But what is science doing about this problem?
According to Scientific American, it was thought that emissions from reservoirs were about 20% of all man-made methane releases, but the concern is that reservoirs are emitting much more methane than previously believed.
Some research is suggesting that all the world's reservoirs emit nearly as much methane, if not more, than all that from burning fossil fuels.
According to Scientific American, the EPA was to begin measuring methane emissions in 25 reservoirs from Indiana to Georgia this year. And finally, speaking of methane, that jack-o'-lantern you so painstakingly carved last week, it may be killing the planet.
That is, at least according to the Department of Energy.
In a blog post last week, the agency warned that many Halloween pumpkins will be tossed into landfills and contribute to climate change.
The DOE estimates that 254 million tons of pumpkin goes into waste sites where they decompose and eventually release methane.
Additionally, every year, 1.3 billion pumpkins are grown in the U.S. alone. That's a huge hit to the environment because it takes a lot of land and water to grow that many gourds, all for something we don't even eat.
But the Department of Energy is not trying to be a buzzkill. The agency pointed out that there's a huge opportunity for clean energy, turning that waste into fuel. The department has two integrated biorefineries planned. When in full operation, they will produce 92 million gallons of biofuel per year for the military.
Until then, they recommend composting your pumpkin, which, unlike a landfill, decomposes with oxygen and doesn't create methane. Or you can toss them in your yard and let the squirrels and birds or other wildlife eat them. You know, let nature do its thing. Pumpkin. This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Pumpkin, 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 pumpkin.